The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Grafton Tanner is a writer and musician from Georgia. His writing has appeared in Paste Magazine, Film Matters, and The Blue Indian, and his debut book, Babbling Corpse, Vaporwave and the Commodification of Ghosts, was published by Zero Books on June 24th, 2016. What is Vaporwave? Here's the YouTube star Frank Jav C to explain.
Vaporwave.
To understand vaporwave, you must
feel the vapor, breathe in the vapor, be the vapor, taste the vapor.
What's that taste, you may ask? It's the taste of consumerist society,
and it tastes freaking delicious.
It's Thursday, September 8th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Before we begin, I want to thank Mir B, Samus M, Paul H, Matthew D, Brad P, Dave W, and Nigel W for becoming Zero Books Club members. That's right, these brave men enlisted before the official podcast announcement reached their ears. And, by the way, this is that announcement. So what is the Zero Books Club and what do Zero Book Club members get? What do they access? First off, members gain access to our new Inside Zero Books podcast. This is the second hour of the Zero Books podcast every week, and it will feature conversations about the left and left publishing with members of the Zero Books editorial team. That is, you'll hear from Ashley Frowley, myself, C. Derek Varn, and Alfie Bound, as well as from other authors and thinkers from around the world. We'll be discussing political theory and the ups and downs of radical publishing within a clickbait culture. Second, you'll gain access to participate in bi-monthly online workshops in critical theory or cultural theory or philosophy run by Zero Books authors. Upcoming workshops will feature Daniel Coffeen and Mike Watson. They'll be teaching or talking about Deleuze and or conceptual art. Thirdly, members will get access to audiobooks from our Advancing Conversations book series on a quarterly basis. Upcoming titles include conversations with longevity researcher Aubrey de Grey, a conversation with the satirical novelist Jeff Nicholson, and a conversation with Zippy the Pinhead cartoonist Bill Griffith. There'll be other books as well. Those are in the works on Marxism and liberal politics and so on. Members will also receive occasional promotional discounts on selected Zero Books titles and the knowledge that they are supporting an international critical theory and left politics publisher, one The Guardian described as one of the most exciting radical presses of the moment. Of course, that was back in 2011. There is also a secret Zero Books writing workshop available for select members, so please do join and look into how you can contact us about that. I'll give you a hint. The way to contact me about the writer's workshop is to contact me through my own personal webpage. That's douglaslane.net. This episode includes an advertisement for the Macintosh Plus, a clip from the Internet Club's hit Pacific, a clip from Chuck Person's Eco Jams Volume 1, a Cabin in the Woods collage, and the newly invented Vaporwave Nike Revolution with George Carlin. The music you're listening to right now is Grafton Tanner's own Rising from the Past. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Tanner and I discuss his book, Babbling Corpses. Let's talk about vaporwave. Will you tell me what it is? Because, you know, I've heard it, but I still don't know what it is. My son likes it a lot. He's going off to university, actually, soon. And for a long time, all he would listen to was video game music. Maybe orchestrated. Like, oh yeah, this is the music from the Legends of Zelda. And now he listens to vaporwave as he's gotten more mature. So anyway, what is vaporwave?
That's really interesting. Vaporwave is, well, it makes a lot of sense that he would listen to it if he grew up listening to the soundtracks of video games, because that is kind of what vaporwave does, is it reframes that kind of the background music of video games or like radio, background radio sounds or elevator music or Muzak. And it's supposed to reframe that so that maybe you can listen to it in a different way. I think that's probably a really basic definition. So a lot of these producers that I mentioned in the book, they will take snippets and samples, usually a lot of times really short, you know, almost random samples of background music, elevator music or bumper music, stuff you maybe would hear in the background of a commercial. And take samples of that kind of filler music and loop them for an a certain amount of time and put all this crazy reverb and sort of degrading kind of audio effects like reverb and stuff to make it sound actually terrible. Like maybe you're listening to it on like a halfway broken boombox or something. So and it really is like particular to the sounds of people who maybe grew up in the 80s or 90s, and so it has there's a certain kind of sample that a vaporwave producer is looking for. Even like you may turn on a commercial in 2016 and the background music is like, I think what's in vogue is kind of like the folksy sort of, you know, post Lumineers kind of like filler music. But that wouldn't be in a vaporwave song. Instead, it would be like a Phil Collins clip you might hear in a supermarket.
I grew up in the 70s. I mean, like I was born in 71, just at the cusp between 70 and 71. I became a teenager and an adult in the late 80s. And so this music that I hear in vaporwave, that's really familiar to me. To me, that is pop music. Quintessential pop music, but you wouldn't find Lady Gaga in vaporwave either.
You probably wouldn't, and it kind of makes you wonder how people will make vaporwave in the future if it's if the source material kind of seems to focus on just, you know, possibly two decades of pop music. So yeah, you wouldn't find Lady Gaga. However, you might one day, because there's the producer who's like kind maybe sort of credited as helping to start vaporwave, Daniel Lopatin. He has the 106 Point Never project. Mm-hmm. His most recent album is kind of like vaporwave updated to like the early 2000s with that kind of like, or like late 90s, early 2000s, like new metal, Korn, aggro metal kinds of sounds. So I, you know, as we go further into the future, maybe the source material, you know, will update. Maybe we will eventually get to, you know, Lady Gaga.
Now, is the first vaporwave ever made Macintosh Plus?
It's not the first, but it's kind of like the most famous.
Okay. Now, I had a Macintosh Plus when I was in high school, right? I mean, not at home, but in high school. What is the relationship of to the Macintosh Plus, you know, which somehow is related to vaporwave, for this kid? I mean, what generation are we talking about? Are we talking about people born after 2000 that are making this, or?
Well, it's hard to tell, because one of the things about the vaporwave community, just from talking to a few of the producers myself, is I don't know the ages of a lot of them. I do know that some of them are young. In fact, some of the first vaporwave projects to show up on the internet, my knowledge was that at least one of them was like 18 years old. So you're looking at maybe people
But my kid's age, people born in the late 90s. You know.
Exactly, yeah. And I was born in 90, so I'm 25. And so possibly my age or younger, but it's hard to tell. And in fact, you know, there are a lot of vaporwave projects with just one person behind it. And then there are, you know, it's hard to tease it out. I think that's...
Have you ever used a Macintosh Plus?
I didn't really grow up with a computer in my home, actually. I was like that kid, you know. But I've seen one.
Introducing Macintosh. It does all the things you'd expect a business computer to do. It does a lot of things you wouldn't expect a business computer to do. And it does some things no other business computer has ever done before. Of course, to do all this, you will have to learn to do this. Macintosh, the computer for the rest of us.
But I remember reading about something called the Internet Aesthetic, which is not that it's not, vaporwave seems like it's just a, would fit under that umbrella term. The Internet Aesthetic is when something is degraded, and when something is shoddily made or looks amateur, it has more authenticity, and it actually might travel further and become more viral and be seen to be more cool, especially because if it's degraded, digitally degraded, that degradation is a mark of its being viral, of its being reproduced by many, many different people who with various software at various skill levels. So you see a meme and it's, you know, the pixels are showing.
Exactly.
And you know that's a great meme.
Right. Yeah, if it looks terrible. Yeah.
And there's something to that at vaporwave. It's like this is some bit of trash that the internet's just belching up from who knows when.
Exactly, yeah. And that's why there are a lot of, you know, I've encountered people who don't understand why people still want to talk about vaporwave, why it's, there's always new vaporwave music being made, and why why I would write a book on it, why anybody would ever talk about it again, because I think it was there was a time when it was just kind of immediately disregarded as just total trash, which you know I come from cultural studies and we love trash. I mean, if you know, the trashier the cult movie, the cooler you are that you wrote a research paper on it or something. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
It was almost like, okay, this is just a meme. And then now it has kind of like outlived its meme-ness a bit because, you know, you had people like Tiny Mixtapes who, you know, they were finding these albums. That's how I first came across it and writing about them and saying like, this is actually really, really cool and possibly important stuff, even though it is trash.
Okay, two questions, two more musical questions. Then we can talk about politics a little bit. But
yeah, right on.
Okay, so have you ever heard of a band called Negative Land?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So the mashup and the culture jamming that Negative Land represented, you know, and they started in, I think, the early 80s, maybe even before that, but certainly by the early 80s they've been around. They're getting old and dying now, actually.
I know. I saw it on the news, yeah.
So how much of vaporwave do you think is working in that somewhat older tradition, not really old tradition, or also like might relate to what was zine culture?
I think vaporwave is entirely like in that lineage of culture jammers like Negative Land or John Oswald. I first encountered Negative Land some years ago, and then I remember coming across writings that Simon Reynolds had done on Negative Land, and I was just like, wow, this is so true. But I didn't think of them. I didn't think of really any sort of like cultural jamming when I first heard vaporwave, because the first thing I thought of was the YouTube poop that is of like King of the Hill and all these old, like, you know, a few years old cartoons and stuff where people chop them up and make them into totally ridiculous versions of themselves. That's the first thing I thought of because it has that kind of choppy, glitchy aesthetic. But it's absolutely in line with Negative Land. And in fact, it makes you realize there's nothing, they're not, the vaporwave producers aren't really doing anything new. it's just, I guess, like this this era's version of what Negative Land did in the 80s.
Yeah, back then in the 80s and into the 90s, and they're still doing stuff now, the ones that are left, I think. But back then, you had to be sort of a hobbyist, certain kind of nerd, to create music on machines that way. I mean, it goes back to like the BBC and the Doctor Who theme and concrete music, where you're using the technology just to make noises in a different way. But now, everybody's got this box in their room. They grow up using it. It dominates everything. You know, I've always got 10 tabs open on some, like right now I've got 10 tabs open on a browser that I'm not looking at for no reason. So yeah, so you live with this constant mash of information and you know, through this box, so anybody can become Negative Land. It's not hard.
Exactly. And all of everything on the internet nearly is Negative Land. I mean, because it's so easy, and because everyone's always on there, the platform exists. All you got to do is upload it. And I think that's the allure of Vaporwave, is that anybody can illegally rip Ableton Live on their computer, drag something in it, take a few minutes. It doesn't mean it doesn't take a long time to make good Vaporwave. It just means that the idea of trying to mess around with sound and do what these people did with samplers, when they had to go out and buy a sampler, even prior to that, and they had radios running or like giant modular synths or whatever. It's just, it's extremely easy now to not make the same kind of music, but do similar things as what they were doing decades previously, and then cut out the middleman and post it right online, and then you have an overabundance of stuff. And the majority of it is you know, weird and strange and just jamming the culture, but you know, the best vaporwave is the stuff that makes you think it was easy to make, but it wasn't.
Do you think that the people who are interested in or producing vaporwave are also kind of fans of Brian Eno and or like Philip Glass or?
I mean, I think so, because I think that it really, I consider it, I don't really sit around and listen to a lot of vaporwave. I like it a lot. I like thinking about it. But when I did, it is very entrancing. Mm-hmm. And when friends and I would get around, you know, the screen and watch, you know, the videos of vaporwave, like to the music or whatever that some people would upload, it's very, yeah. So, I mean, it does have a lot in line with ambient music. I think its effect, to me, is a bit more jarring and noticeable, at least at first, listening to like the classic vaporwave stuff that was some of the first stuff to come online, where very simplified formula, you know, short sample repeated over and over again. Sometimes the sample cut very strangely and repeated at odd moments. Mm-hmm. That's jarring at first, and you know, if you listen to the entire 3 minutes of something like that, you might eventually get bored or relaxed with it or maybe tune it out. But it functions a little differently than ambient, in that I think it's supposed to catch you off guard a little bit more.
It sounds like ambient, and then suddenly there's a click or some noise, and then a whole new track will start up. Sometimes.
Right. Yeah, it'll just like loop right back at the beginning of a string. A perfect example is like the song called Pacific by Internet Club, and it's just got this like grooving, you know, fusion sort of like band going crazy, and it just loops at the strangest moments. It's always the same time, but it's cut so jaggedly.
See, now I'm just going to type that into my one of my tabs here.
We'll be right back.
All right, so your book, Babbling Corpse. What does the title mean?
I got the title after reading Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which is one of the kind of begins the first chapter, and the idea of hollowed dead bodies with voices ringing through them or something. There's a certain deadness to vaporwave, and it does. Everyone always talks about like vaporwave being dead, or it was a genre that dead on arrival, in the sense that it doesn't like it. It has the sound of something kind of functioning, a music playing or what have you, like outside of your control, and it's like this, you know, looping sounds. And I write at the beginning of the book about like the uncanny and the idea that like you said, you know, we have our technology with us 24/7. We work on our laptops all day, every day, smartphones. And so the idea, I think the idea that these things are still machines separate from human beings, and that they could still malfunction, I think that idea was easier to remember back in the day of faulty electronic early analog televisions and early transistor radios. That, you know, if I mean that, you know, I even remember growing up with computers that went buggy suddenly and messed up. Just, I mean, it messed up more than it worked, and it doesn't seem to be happening really much anymore, because the technology's gotten better and you know, ubiquitous Wi-Fi. And so the idea of that, I think one of the things the vaporwave really does well is this idea that, you know, kind of a reminder that technology is still technology. It could still mess up. It could still malfunction. And the vaporwave music is the sound of that malfunctioning. Something like something haunted, or something that's been like animated by something outside of your presence. And suddenly the familiarity of your technology turns strange. It's not the same thing as it was anymore, because it's malfunctioning.
So it's a malfunction, but it's a malfunction that is sought after.
Daniel Lopatin has his Chuck Person's Echo Jams Volume 1, very, very, very strange sort of precursor to vaporwave. And a lot of that music is like violently sabotaged, you know, like samples of like Fleetwood Mac songs that are just like, you know, put through the shredder. And at the other end, it's this alien kind of music. So the title has something to do with haunted culture, haunted technology, the idea that the technology is separate. It's so ubiquitous that I think that, you know, we don't really think of it as it being very that strange much anymore. And vaporwave is kind of the reminder, is like, you know, it may not be very strange now, but technology comes from, you know, it used to be a lot stranger. I think that's just one of the ways to read the genre.
Chapter 2 of your book is entitled Erasing the Human Anthrodecentrism and Cosmic Horror. What is anthrodecentrism, and how does it relate to comic cosmic horror? Because you have the S there in parentheses.
Well, anthrodecentrism is a really jargony way of saying, like, human beings aren't masters of the house, I think is what I think Graham Harman's his philosopher is when he talks about the idea that the human being, I mean, I the human being isn't that special when, you know, related to other animals and related to you know, technology. And I don't think it's a concept that many people previously, before the 21st century, I think that concept might be a bit strange, but I haven't found many people that I talk with about, like, some of this stuff that they're resistant to the idea that humans aren't the ordained kings of the planet. And I think one of the reasons for that is the specter of climate change, global climate change, that has that's everywhere in the news, and it is a actual scientific threat that is oftentimes denied. How this ties into vaporwave is the second chapter has a lot to do with the idea of dread in culture and, like, the anxiety of losing humanness, of being human. Mm-hmm. And again, this kind of ties into the idea of, like, you know, the haunted technology, or what, you know, Jeff Sconce, who's this theorist at Northwestern, would call, like, haunted media, and the idea of your technology running amok without you, operating on its own. And vaporwave is kind of the sound of that occurring. How this would tie into cosmic comic horror is that a lot of contemporaries, like, take, for example, in the book, talk about Cabin in the Woods, the film Cabin in the Woods. This idea that you as a human, you're not, you know, in the grand universe of things and other animals, you're just one of many. That idea could be both horrifying and actually really funny.
Oh,
Because chapter 4 is called Sick and Tired, 9/11 and Regressive Culture in the 21st Century. So what does Vaporwave have to tell us about 9/11 from the perspective of someone who was 11 when that happened?
Yeah, I know. Like, I think, well, when I talked to Ramona Xavier, who is kind of credited as helping to really refine the Vaporwave genre, she talked a lot about, and I am not quite sure how old she is. I know she's a similar age as I am, so we both experienced 9/11 at an extremely young age. And I think it's the for her, she said that there was this kind of the towering gloom of that event to start off this century, and the rapid acceleration of technology that occurred a few years later, and then the 2008 economic recession that began. And I, for my generation specifically, there is a sort of dread mentality or a giving up mentality. The millennial culture, the idea that the future is not going to be any better than the past. And I pinpoint this at 9/11 because for me, it's like what Zizek said, the 1-2 punch of history or whatever, which was the first punch of 9/11 and the second punch of the 2008 economic meltdown, which kind of knocked Western, especially United States, Western society off at the knees or whatever. I think that any sort of kind of blatant nostalgia baiting that's done in culture, I think you have to trace it in some way to 9/11. Because it is kind of like the acceleration to stasis point, flattening point of culture and the idea that that you can hide in the past before what occurred in 2001. And a lot of the vaporwave source material comes from before 2001. It comes from, the 80s and the 90s, back when we had obviously a different technological moment and a different political moment. So to me, that's kind of like the one of the connections.
So it is the perspective there that you can reach back to the Reagan era and find sort of a mom and pop, white picket fence, American dream reality, or to pilfer and make fun of, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
'cause that's hilarious to me.
Yeah. Well, that's the strange thing about it, is that so much of the vaporwave like look and feel and aesthetic is so 80s that anybody who lived through the 80s would say, like, are you kidding? Like, I remember I talked to Greg Moffitt. We did a podcast and he was just like, I lived through the 80s. What's the big deal?
Right.
You know, what was the... what's the big thing? And I think it has, I think for vaporwave, at least, it has less to do with the politics maybe and more to do with the technology and the simple kind of like imagery, just the actual imagery of 80s and 90s culture and the memories of that culture kind of coming back again the internet is like the great remembering tool. And I think, the idea that you can access any previous icon of history or any previous piece of culture on the internet that would have normally just been forgotten over time. And of course, the first thing that my generation is going to look up is the stuff that they encountered in the 80s and 90s when they were growing up. I don't think there's any accident that the aesthetic of vaporwave is 80s and 90s.
No, I mean, I love it, but I love it, I think, for all the wrong reasons. You know, it's like, yeah, I was nostalgic for the 80s before you were born. So
exactly.
Well, it's not exactly true because you're born 1990, but still, I could say that to some of these kids. But okay, so here's the interesting thing. I had two thoughts. I'll say the more minor thought first, which is that it seems to me that my generation felt... the Gen X felt that we had come at the end of history, that we were looking back to a time, which is the 50s and 60s, when there was such a thing as an American dream, but we were born, having been born in the 70s, after the 60s destroyed that, and you know, we were the most cynical generation ever, and the most media savvy and technologically saturated generation. That was the story on us. This is a story on millennials too. What's very strange for me to when I read about millennials is to just see how it almost completely echoes what was said about Generation X. And then you think about that for a little bit and you realize, go back and read what people were reading, what people were writing about the baby boomers. The me generation, you know, they're coddled. You know, they didn't go through a world war like their parents. They're TV babies. You know, this idea, this that of the I'm going to call it the Gen X idea from my, you know, privileging my own generation. It seems like it's going on and on.
The baby boomers, whiny, narcissistic, self-indulgent people with a simple philosophy: give me it, it's mine. Give me that, it's mine. These people were given everything. Everything was handed to them. And they took it all. Took it all. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And they stayed loaded for 20 years and had a free ride. But now they're staring down the barrel of middle-age burnout. And they don't like it. They don't like it. So they turn self-righteous. And they want to make things hard on younger people. They tell them abstain from sex. Say no to drugs. As for the rock and roll, they sold that for television commercials a long time ago. So they could buy pasta machines and Stairmasters and soybean futures. Soybean futures. You know something? They're cold, bloodless people. It's in their slogans. It's in their rhetoric. No pain, no gain. Just do it. Life is short. Play hard. Shit happens. Deal with it. Get a life. These people went from do your own thing to just...
I guess the only difference is that with each new generation, obviously the technology changes. The savviness is still there. There's something particular about millennials that I'm speaking as one because I'm in that generation, but the millennial culture. So I would call it like a neutered left or something culture, which might get me in trouble, but it's like, That millennial culture is – there's a difference there, I think, because the technology is almost like never questioned, is an absolute given because they grew up with it, you know, grew up entirely from day one with it. You know, the same could be said about the television, obviously, people growing up watching TV. But I think the interactivity of social media, for example, and the internet at large is so unique. And I think that's what separates the millennial generation from so many others is that the social aspect, I think, changes with greater severity. I mean, we all move from front porches to inside in front of the TVs to maybe still being in front of the TV, but then everybody on their phones.
Right.
In the living room, you know what I mean? The social cocooning or whatever I think sociologists call it. But to me, that's like the defining characteristic of what separates millennials from Gen X.
Yeah. No, we didn't have phones when we were sitting in front of our TVs.
Right.
We didn't have the cell phones. Most of us didn't.
And then the economic situation, I would say, is even stranger.
Well, you know, the late 80s and early 90s, there was a recession, you know, going on. We had,
right.
And there was Generation X is about a generation whose prospects, I mean, that book specifically, is about a generation whose prospects were worse than their parents. That's what, you know, the term McJobs comes from Douglas Coupland's book, Generation X.
Right. Yeah.
So, so that was another part of Gen X was the economic crisis. And then if you go back to the origins of Generation X, which is actually the baby boomers. It goes back that far. There was a, that's when the term was actually coined. There was also this, there was a book called Growing Up Absurd and how the economy wasn't producing enough meaningful jobs and how technology was disrupting everything back in the late 50s, I think, is when it goes back to. So the thing I wanted to throw at you is if you want to look to this, maybe the source of this aesthetic, you look to right after World War One with Dada.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Because then that was a war that the technology had come along and made the human destruction unbearable. Mm-hmm. The battlefields were like a science fiction movie before science fiction was even a thing.
Right.
After that, you had a movement of poets and artists who were rejecting Western culture, trying to destroy it and create something new.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. I mean, yes, absolutely.
So anyway, I'm just saying I'm not knocking any of this at all. I think there's something really interesting about it. But what I guess my message would be, and maybe it's a defensive one, as somebody who's not aging, you know, gracefully, meaning I don't know how well I look, but also I just, you know, leaving my 20s took me 10 years. You know, I was 40 already before I was fully accepting the fact that I was no longer in my 20s.
Right.
So. So, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that in what I'm saying, but there's also, I think, a truth to the fact that, yes, each generation has to go through this, but I think it's actually defining, it's not really attached to one generation. It's something that it defines our culture and shifts as technology changes.
If it crops up in each new generation, it does seem to be in contrast to some kind of technological shift.
You're right. It's about that because it is different. My kids are different than I am. But they are no – it's not that their relationship to technology is different than my relationship to technology. Well, my son is better at it than I am. It's very frustrating. He can fix my computer and I can't do that. But I've been online since – 92.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I had my first computer when I was 12 and got my first modem when I was 13, 14 and was using it to talk to my friend down the street. Just to use his computer, my computer would connect. That's it. You know, we'd chat at each other. It was like texting with two big 1982 yeah. computers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's been around all that time, but it was new then, and it's now the background radiation. So that must be different.
I think one of the main differences is that I don't think my generation knows when they are on their phones or when they're engaging in technology. I think that they take it so for granted that they're on it without realizing they're on it. You know, like in the earlier days of the internet, you know, even just in the days of dial-up, it's like there is this sort of conscious effort of like, I'm going to get on the computer now and I'm going to dial up and I'm going to boot it. I'm going to be on, and while I'm on, I'm on, and when I'm off, I'm not on it.
Right.
And I don't think, I think that is not the case anymore.
Technology shaped us. It's something to that I need to remember, I guess. But your book is selling. You know, it's not just like hotcakes, but it's every month it's selling more. It seemed like.
Good to hear.
Yeah, but not very many copies are selling as ebooks.
Interesting. Oh my goodness! Now wait a minute. Hey,
everyone's getting the paper.
Interesting. That might be. Huh. Wonder what that says.
I don't know. I'm asking you.
Yeah. Oh well.
Are people turning away from the ebook? Is that a dying thing?
I mean, I can honestly say of people that I know who read regularly, I don't know of a single one that has an e-reader. Or I don't even see anybody. I mean, I think that like probably the place to see e-readers would be like what, like on a plane or something, like flying through the air. And yeah. I don't like travel for a living or anything, so. But I just don't see it. I mean, if I see anybody reading, I see them reading on their phones or in a book. And I don't ever see anybody reading a book on a phone.
Right.
So I've personally never read an ebook. I think it's cool. I mean, I was hoping that the print copies would sell more anyway.